It is Monday, May the 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up, the Iraqi government crisis and what Washington can do.
Nobody wants the Americans to come in and dictate any kind of political solution. And the American footprint has been very, very heavy in the last week.
Also ahead, stopping the violence in Syria so peace can break out. A new documentary about Russia's President Putin, plus the latest from entertainer Beyoncé. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Iraq's capital, Baghdad, teetered on the edge of political chaos on Sunday. The city in a state of emergency. Protesters had occupied parts of the once secure international zone, also known as the Green Zone. VOA's Sharon Bain is in Iraq.
As of right now, it's actually quite murky. There is no more parliament. Most of the lawmakers were forced to flee yesterday when the followers of a firebrand Shiite cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr, they stormed into the Green Zone and actually took over part of it, stormed into the parliament, forced the lawmakers to flee. Some were kind of roughed up. About 60 or 70 of those lawmakers actually got on a plane, and most of them of the Sunni and Kurdish minorities, they got on a plane and they arrived in Erbil and in the other Kurdish city of Sulaymaniyah. And this is where they're sitting. The rest of the lawmakers are no longer in parliament either. That building has been ransacked. And so as of right now, there's really no standing parliament. I've asked all my contacts and sources in Baghdad, and they say that Prime Minister Hadi Haider al-Abadi is actually still in power. He's still holding the reins. But he and probably the Minister of Interior are probably the only two right now really effective members of the government. So you've got a crisis situation. And right this minute, nobody really knows what the next step is going to be.
That is VOA Sharon Bain in Erbil, Iraq. For some perspective on the breach of Baghdad's Green Zone by the protesters, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, James Jeffrey. He's now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
It was a protest against, for example, it started against the Sunni Arab Speaker of Parliament, Jabouri, and also against the Kurdish president, Fuad Masum, and they're allied with Prime Minister Abadi. The protest involved two factions, which had somewhat different agendas, but both of them were at odds with Prime Minister Abadi. First of all, they were the forces of former Prime Minister Maliki, who didn't want to see Abadi's reform program carried out because it undercuts Maliki's power in the parliament. And the other is Muqtada al-Sadr's group, which wanted to see even more technocratic members of parliament and even more of an overturning of the political party landscape in the parliament and in the government, even though Muqtada is one of the major parties there with some 40 or 50 seats. So granted, these are all Shia parties represented. In fact, Maliki and Abadi are some from the same party, Dawa. But there are huge internal divisions and differences on where to go in the country. So that in the first order, this is a struggle among various Shia factions. But it has gained a life of its own, and it's going to be very hard for Abadi to have the credibility and the support to restore things and continue governing as he has before, or to institute the kind of far-reaching reforms. A lot of this is because he's a weak leader, and a lot of it is because things aren't going well in Iraq, and a lot of it is because it's a divided country.
So is this primarily political infighting among Shia groups?
Primarily, yes.
What does this do for the fight against Islamic State?
It does three things. First of all, to the extent there's worries about masses of protesters, remember, these are Muqtada al-Sadr's protesters. He also has his own army. It means that important elements of Iraqi's better fighting forces are held in reserve around Baghdad, and that much of the attention of the military leadership is on protecting Baghdad and protecting the leadership rather than planning for the fight. That's the first problem. The second problem is a weakened Abadi is more under the influence of the Iranians on certain things, and one of those things is to minimize the role of the United States. But as we've seen, absent an ever bigger and more central American role in fighting this thing, we're not going to make much progress against ISIS. Things like using Apache helicopters, putting more advisors in, more special forces teams, these are things that incredibly are controversial because the Iranians make them controversial. And then the third thing is you just need a good leader at the top to motivate troops and senior command is to make good decisions and to hold with those decisions. A body is at best weak in this regard and preoccupied with this crisis and basically on the run, at least the way he's been for the last 2 days. It's very hard to get decisions out of it. So in all three ways, this is going to hurt the effort.
So what is the way forward? I mean, the U.S. is its footprint is even larger now, and that's going to cause problems with Iran, right?
Well, it causes problems with the Iraqis as well. Nobody wants the Americans to come in and dictate any kind of political solution. And the American footprint has been very, very heavy in the last week. Vice President Biden coming in following Secretary Kerry and Secretary Carter. Whether this is helpful or not, I don't know. As a general rule, when I was out there, tried to fend off top-level visits while we're trying to work things out, because you can't do them quietly. And if there's visibility, then the angst factor of many people, including both the one people who want us to work with the Americans and people who want to fight us, tend to go up. But, you know, that's the call of the government. The point is, we have very little control over this, Victor.
That's former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, James Jeffrey, now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. And among the world's top stories this hour, on May Day, workers rallied for rights and higher wages, the first U.S. Zika death amid a funding stalemate. The race for U.S. president is tightening up, plus Ghana's opposition party picking a former first lady as their presidential candidate. Expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry arrived in Geneva on Sunday in an urgent bid to revive a U.S.-Russian brokered ceasefire that has all but fallen apart as Syrian government forces intensified their attacks, especially in Syria's largest city, Aleppo, over the past 10 days. VOA asked Trinity University Middle East scholar David Lesh what all the prospects might be for ending the fighting between the Syrian government troops and the rebels.
Well, I think the prospects are small. I think the so-called cessation of hostilities is on life support, and certainly Secretary of State Kerry and perhaps even the Russians are desperately trying to maintain the illusion that some form of it continues, because they don't want the momentum, little that it was, built up with the cessation of hostilities that went into effect February 27th, and then the subsequent continuing negotiations between the government and opposition groups in Geneva. They don't want that just to end cold. So they're trying their best to come up with any sort of definition that gives a perception that there is still hope and that there still is a continuing process, even coming up with a term I've never heard before called a regime of calm, which the Russians and the U.S. Agreed to apparently with the government in Damascus to continue a cessation of hostilities around Damascus and in the northwest of the country around Latakia, but not in Aleppo, which, of course, where all the fighting seems to be occurring right now. And it appears to me that the regime wants the Syrian regime wants Aleppo, and they feel it's within their grasp. How much the Russians are helping them in this? It seems as though the regime couldn't do this completely without the Russians, but the Russians also, I think, don't want to have this situation totally obliterate any hope for a negotiated settlement.
The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the attacks over the weekend continued to take a heavy toll on civilians in Aleppo, where activists say nearly 250 people have been killed in the past 10 days. To discuss all of this, Secretary Kerry will meet later today with his Saudi counterpart, Adel bin Ahmed Al Jubeir, and the UN Special Envoy for Syria, Stephane de Mistura. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palkov.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America, hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your peek, watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Salih, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Salih saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Next up, VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with Anastasia Kirilenko, an independent Russian investigative journalist and co-producer of the recent documentary film Who is Mr. Putin, which explores the rise to power of Russian President Vladimir Putin and the cloud of corruption allegations that have surrounded him and his inner circle. Here's Carol Castiel.
Anastasia, congratulations on this film, which I myself viewed last week, its premiere with English subtitles at the Hudson Institute, a think tank here in Washington. Tell us in your words, what is the purpose of the film? Why did you do this, and who is your main audience?
I was even asked why to speak about personal enrichment of Putin if he did even worse things like annexation of Crimea, etc. My point, Putin is a dangerous liar, and he was lying about his career, his position at KGB since the very beginning. What the movie is showing, it's how he cooperated with even criminal gangs, representatives. We showed many documents, many interviews on that. All the documents will be public at the Kleptocracy Archive at the Hudson Institute. So the idea was also to spread widely this knowledge about Putin.
How many people do you think in Russia have seen this? How has the video been received in Russia by Russians?
As for now, I think 2.5 million Russian speakers have seen it, and there were discussions on social media, not mainstream, but several left-wing media in Russia. It was received well. Also, politicians very well known, like Garry Kasparov and others, wrote that they learned new things, even though they knew already much, but this movie was important for them.
Of course, Garry Kasparov is a democracy advocate. He ran for president, or rather, he was a politician, and now, of course, he lives in New York City. We interviewed him last year, and, of course, he is promoting human rights. Of course, he's a great chess champion as well. Picking up on something you said, Anastasia, we know that President Putin, his regime, controls pretty much all the levers of media. He's in control now of television, radio, and much of the print. So this state control of the media certainly restricts people's access to unbiased information. So to that extent, you have a major obstacle in getting your message out.
Yes, of course. I think it will be like a marathon distance, like a very time-consuming work to get the audience in Russia and to persuade them or to tell them the truth about Putin. But the principle of work of the mafia state to protect their assets and their personal assets, they bought media. Because already in the 90s, when Putin started numerous illicit affairs, for example, he was behind the Bank Russia, now well-known. For example, mafia representatives were shareholders, and also Putin's neighbors of Dacia. This Bank Russia started to buy media already in the 90s. And when he rose to power to presidential position, it continued. And now, exactly, you got the point, Russian audience is hardly to be accessible. They are brainwashed. Yeah. And it's because 80% of mainstream news are dedicated to Putin, Putin's strongman. So it's a hard struggle, let's say, but I'm proud that this movie, my movie, it's 100% Russian production, which is already better for Russian audience than BBC or something, because I have a Russian passport and I can't be accused that I'm a foreigner and I understand nothing. When somebody in Russia tells me Putin is great, strong, etc., I usually answer I'm better informed about him.
Anastasia Kirilenko is co-producer of the documentary, Who is Mr. Putin? She was speaking with Carol Castiel, host of the VOA program, Press Conference USA. You can hear more of their conversation by going to our website, voanews.com, and look under the Programs tab for Press Conference USA. Well, it turns out that the road to the White House swings through the mid-U.S. state of Indiana this week, which turns out to be a pivotal contest among Republican presidential candidates. International Edition's Jim Stevenson speaks with VOA's Michael Bowman about it all.
Indiana is perhaps the knife's edge on which Donald Trump's quest to win the Republican presidential nomination outright is sort of teetering on. The conventional wisdom was, about a month ago, that he was going to have trouble pulling together the 1,237 delegates that he would need. However, he won his home state of New York. He swept all five Northeastern primaries, Mid-Atlantic Northeastern primaries last week. And there is a new poll out showing him with a 15 percentage point lead in Indiana. If that holds up, he will be on a path, not necessarily a glide path, but certainly a path where 1,237 delegates is very much within his reach.
It seems that the Republican establishment, if you will, has pretty much come to terms that Donald Trump will likely be the nominee for the party. However, John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, and Texas Senator Ted Cruz had made this pact about a week ago to try to stop Trump from getting as many delegates as he needs to win a first-round ballot and possibly then take the ballot on a second round, one of the other two. And so this is the state where Kasich allegedly agreed to just kind of back off and let Cruz go head-to-head against Trump.
Indeed. And even with that pact, and no one really could see how that would work very well, but even with that pact and Kasich sort of letting Cruz have a free hand in Indiana, Cruz, according to the latest polling data, is trailing Trump by a significant margin. And this strategy of denying Trump the nomination by preventing him from winning it outright in a first round and then locking up the loyalty of all the delegates, that only works if you prevent Trump from getting 1,237 in the first round. And as inconceivable as that might have seemed a year ago or even just a few months ago, he is marching towards that very possibility.
And to help him out, he picked Carly Fiorina as a vice presidential running mate, something that's almost unheard of at this point in the process.
You know, putting the cart in front of the horse. I don't know. This seems to be putting an entire wagon train in front of a horse. Yes, Ted Cruz decided that he would name his running mate before he's even secured the nomination. And when he's won only about half the delegates that he would need for the nomination, with only a few states left to go, I do see the logic in it. Carly Fiorina is from California. She ran in a Senate race. She was beaten rather soundly, but she does strike a lot of the conservative themes. And if you are looking for any possible edge that you could possibly get going towards the end of the nominating process, well, California is the biggest state in the nation. It is the biggest delegate prize out there, and it's one of the last remaining states. And if Ted Cruz thinks that Carly Fiorina can give him some sort of edge in California, and that edge might deny Trump the 1,237 delegates, then I suppose it's a Hail Mary worth taking.
Mm-hmm. Just maybe. VOA correspondent Michael Bowman speaking with my colleague Jim Stevenson. Well, the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner was held here in Washington over the weekend. Members of the press were there along with entertainers, other notables, and of course, President and Mrs. Obama. Our social media expert, G. Abby Lee, has the word on all the online buzz about the event. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. The best way to find out more info about the dinner is by using the hashtag WHCD, that stands for White House Correspondents' Dinner, and hashtag NerdProm.
That's great. You know, we're all a bit nerdy here in the Capitol in Washington. I'm sure this kept the White House social media team very busy over the weekend.
That's right, but not because of live tweeting or streaming. Neither the White House at White House nor President Obama at POTUS live tweeted the event, but the social media team had a bigger fish to fry, and that fish was in the form of a short video clip. The White House tweeted, "Watch POTUS in Couch Commander." It's a comedic description of President Obama's last several months at the White House as a quote-unquote lame duck commander-in-chief.
Yeah, I saw the video on Facebook. It was really something. Going back to the dinner, what did people say about it on social media?
Mostly positive things from what I can gather, but keep in mind, President Obama has always been popular among the younger generations, many of whom are more active on social media than, let's say, baby boomers. Mm-hmm. Many social media users commented they liked the fact that Mr. Obama doesn't take himself too seriously.
Any controversies?
You bet there was. First Lady Michelle Obama's dress was widely talked about. She wore a dress custom-made by the fashion house Givenchy. In many magazines wrote she looked fantastic with a sparkle, but some people criticized her for wearing a designer dress. Last but not least, comedian Larry Wilmore is also trending. He spoke at the dinner and is now in the hot seat for his diction, including the use of the N-word referring to the president. Back to you, Steve.
And many thanks, G. That's her own social media guru, G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Many dog owners like to show affection by hugging them. But a recent article in Psychology Today indicates that giving Fido a hug may not be such a good idea. The article, written by Stanley Coren, a psychology professor and author of several books on dog behavior, suggests that you really shouldn't hug dogs because it raises their stress and anxiety levels. Coren looked at 250 random pictures of people or their children hugging their dogs and looked for signs that indicated the dog wasn't happy being hugged. Those signs include dogs who turn their head away, close their eyes, lower the ears, or they're slicked back against the side of their head. Other signs of a dog's stress and anxiety can include yawning, licking his lips, or even licking your face. Rather than showing fondness for your dog with a hug, Coren suggests that you give your pet a pat, a kind word, or maybe a treat. Good dog. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
I think Rick brought his dog to work. This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Superstar entertainer Beyoncé has released her latest album. You probably heard about it, Lemonade. It was released in a unique way. First, it was on HBO as something called a video artwork. Then it was only available on her husband's download site called Tidal. But it's still expected to debut at number one on the Billboard Albums chart this week. And International Edition's David Berg came along to speak with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the album, of course its visuals, and the unique way of being released.
No one had any idea what this Lemonade thing was. We didn't know, was it going to be an album? Was she, you know, was this a movie? What is she doing exactly? So, like millions of others who had to decide between going to see Purple Rain in honor of Prince, who had just passed away, or sitting in front of the television and watching HBO, I chose to check out Lemonade. So as it turns out, Lemonade is a visual album. It was being promoted as a visual album. So it included a number of songs, new songs, that eventually made it onto an audio album. But they had these very beautiful, stunning visuals around it. So it was like one long music video, an hour-long music video made up of, I think there were about 8 or 9 shorter music videos. Now, those of us who are also interested in the business aspect of this, because of course, Beyoncé is probably one of the best marketeers around. she did this to us before with Beyoncé, her self-titled album, just dropping it in the middle of the night. And, you know, if you weren't on Instagram at that moment, you had no idea until the next day. She kind of did the same thing. But this time, as you say, she released it on HBO. It went away. And then it pops up, surprisingly, but not, on Tidal, which happens to be her husband's streaming service. And then slowly they rolled it out onto iTunes. And I assume at some point you will also be able to purchase a hard copy of this album as well. But this was Beyoncé's new album.
Now, the number one question, how's the music?
It's very different. It's really interesting. It's very different. Now, I don't think that we can really talk about this without, unfortunately, talking about the theme or some of the themes. There's a lot, especially in the beginning, that implies, a lot of the lyrics imply that she and Jay-Z in the past, maybe in the present, who knows, went through a really rough time, and that there were some accusations of infidelity, kind of, if you sort of, you don't even have to read between the lines. She just came right out and said it. So there's a lot of that. It's a very personal album, I think, we think. And then it's about, you know, being angry. It's about being hurt. It's about redemption. It's about coming out of that and becoming a bigger, better, more powerful woman. So it's a powerful album lyrically. Musically, it's all over the place. She managed to make it work, and I'm hearing some really good things about it. I've not experienced it as an album. I've only experienced it as a video piece, but you know, this weekend I'm gonna put my headphones on. I don't think any man around wants to hear it, but I'm gonna put my headphones on and take a listen and see what it sounds like. But I you know, kudos to Beyonce. I mean, she's got us talking, and I think, you know, she put together, at least visually, a very stunning, brilliant piece of work.
All right. Well, what do you think? Have you heard Lemonade, or did you see the HBO special? Send us a tweet. You can send it to Shauna. She is at VOA Lady DJ or at VOA underscore music. You can send one to us. We're at VOA underscore IE. Or you can log on to our website. That's voanews.com.
And many thanks to you, Dave, and to Shauna. I did see the HBO special. Yeah, Beyonce, what can you say? She's spectacular, huh? Well, one quick note I should say. Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus, you know them, for 200 years have been using elephants in their performances. That's over. It all ended on Sunday. They're in line now with what animal rights activists all over the world have said, that you've got to get out of the live animal performance business, and they have. How about that? Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. The latest world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Shadrach Franklin, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope that you have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is not a great time to be an ISIL fighter. Because of the intensified efforts of the counter-ISIL coalition, ISIL, also known as Daesh fighters, are facing pay cuts, a shortage of manpower, a decrease in perks, like using vehicles for personal use, and, more importantly, a shortage of medical expertise, as doctors reportedly flee ISIL-held territory. Now they face a new worry. President Barack Obama approved additional support for Iraqi forces fighting ISIL. On April 25th, President Obama also announced increased support for local forces fighting in Syria.
A small number of American special operations forces are already on the ground in Syria, and their expertise has been critical as local forces have driven ISIL out of key areas. So given the success, I've approved the deployment of up to 250 additional U.S. personnel in Syria, including special forces, to keep up this momentum.
The additional U.S. forces will not be leading the fight on the ground. Instead, they will be assisting and advising indigenous counter-ISIL fighters, including Kurdish, Arab, and other Syrian forces, said State Department spokesperson John Kirby.
Our goal is to provide advice and assistance to all those who can effectively go after Daesh.
At a press briefing, U.S. Air Force Major General Peter Gersten, the U.S.-led coalition's deputy commander for operations and intelligence, said that ISIL's morale is beginning to deteriorate at a fairly increasing rate, adding that fighters have been trying to defect, at times claiming to be refugees and even disguising themselves as women. That's the kind of cowardice we're dealing with. Major General Gersten emphasized, however, that this enemy is a persistent cancer. If left unchecked, it will continue to metastasize and significantly infect the world. Right now, he said, we've got them in a position that they cannot maneuver on the battle space in an effective way. But, he added, we also must understand that this fight requires both patience and time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
It's 4.